Hello, and welcome to Barks Remarks, the podcast where we talk about the stories from the legendary Carl Barks, creator of Scrooge McDuck and writer and artist of the greatest Donald and Scrooge comics of all time. Join us as we explore his longer adventure stories in their chronological publishing order. We'll talk about what makes them so enduring, their historical context, and how well they hold up today. So get out your reprint and get ready to enjoy our remarks. Welcome back to Barks Remarks. I'm Mark Severino, a grown man who loves Duck comics, and I love revisiting stories from when I was a little operator. From my childhood, that is. This is one that I read when I was quite young. But today, I am a big operator, and I'm joined by another big operator, a new guest that I'm delighted to welcome, Elaine Ramshaw. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Mark. It's fun to be here.
It's going to be great to talk about this story today, Pipeline to Danger. Boy, what a cool title that is. But I really think this one is a great opportunity because I feel, Elaine, like this is kind of a relatively obscure Barks adventure story that people don't talk about too much. But I think you and I might have a bit of a special fondness for it. So it'll be nice to talk about the reasons why. And how about you? This is your first time on the show. So when guests join us, I like to hear and I like to let listeners know, basically, you know, why are you here? Are you, as is so often the case, a longtime Duck fan? Do you have a special connection to the comics? What got you into the comics?
So I was born in 1956, and like Don Rosa, I benefited from my older siblings' comics collection, which continued to grow in my childhood. And the best comics were the Duck comics and Little Lulu. I share that with Don Rosa too, as the Little Lulu was the other great one. And Little Lulu, as being the earliest, you know, girl power comic, helped to make up for the general lack of female characters in the Duck world.
Right.
But the Duck world was still certainly my favorite and continued to be. The Gladstone comics started coming out when I was in graduate school, and I discovered them at the second issue and got everything from then on, at least all the Ducks. I had a friend in graduate school at the University of Chicago who was a Barks fan and had hardcover collections. So I began to be able to read some in those and in the Gladstone comics that I hadn't seen in my childhood. And then I had, in the 1990s, a godson was born who was mostly focused on Pokemon for some years and then entirely on computer games. And I couldn't really relate to either of those. But when he was seven, I started him on Barks comics. And on his eighth birthday, I gave him a big, like, file box full of two stacks of Duck comics, including the entire run of Gladstone Uncle Scrooges. And that gave us a common narrative world as he grew up, which was a great benefit for our relationship. And that got me more deeply into the Duck comics, too, as a grown-up.
Well, that's wonderful. So it is such a nice experience, right? The intergenerational connection when someone got into the comics because a parent or an uncle or an aunt read them to them, or when you get to pass them on. You know, I have three kids of my own, and I love reading these comics to them, and they've enjoyed them kind of in varying. They certainly have their favorites they could mention. They've never really gotten into them the way that I have, but it's still a great bonding experience. So you've had kind of the experience that a lot of people have talked about, I assume, where Barks was anonymous when you were first reading these stories. Did you kind of recognize him the way that so many people do, as, quote, the good Duck artist, even if maybe you didn't think of him in those words at the time?
I'm not as visually attuned as a lot of people who love comics. So I'm not sure if I recognized like which stories were drawn by this same great artist and writer. Almost all the stories that I went back to and reread were Barks stories, though. There are a few others.
Right. I think that's the case. There's kind of a sorting effect, right? If you're a fan of these comics, you probably just acquire a lot of them. And then the ones that really get dog-eared and worn out are your favorites. And more likely than not, that's probably going to have some of the great classic bark stuff. So, you know, I mentioned at the outset that, you know, this is kind of a personal favorite of yours. Is that right?
Yeah, it's actually in my top 10 list of barks in long adventure stories.
So that's kind of my like best case scenario when I get people to guest for these comics. Of course, everyone kind of shares the same little universe of favorites, stories that you might expect, like Back to the Klondike and Golden Helmet and Only a Poor Old Man and so forth. But I just love when I can have someone come on about a story that they're especially passionate about. That might be a little bit of a left of center choice because it just makes for a great discussion. So how did this come to be like a favorite of yours, since it is fairly obscure, I would say?
So in childhood, I loved it, I think, because I was the youngest of six children, and I was also always the youngest in my class, and therefore usually sort of physically smallest. And the theme of this story about bigness and littleness and the, you know, the victory of the little over the big was super empowering for me, right? And then I have continued to love it as an adult, partly because it doesn't have anything very problematic about it, as some of the bark stories do, right? I think it treats the people very well and very respectfully.
Yeah, that's a nice thing to point out, right? Oh, I'd want to make sure before we really dive specifically into the story, I'd love to give you the opportunity, as I try to remember to do with new guest hosts, to mention a few of your favorite bark stories apart from this one.
So should I bring up my list here? Because I'm not going to be able to remember it.
if you would like to bring up your list, but is it a top 10 list?
Yeah.
If you want to kind of rattle them off, then that's fine.
So yeah, the other day I read you off my top 10 list, which has Pipeline to Danger, The Phantom of Notre Duck, The Unsafe Safe, A Cold Bargain, North of the Yukon, Back to the Klondike, The Old Castle Secret, Lost in the Andes, 24 Karat Moon, and Land Beneath the Ground.
Nice. It's a solid list, and I like that it's got a nice mix of earlier and later Bark's adventures. You mentioned Land Beneath the Ground, you know, which is like, of course, a favorite of many, many. And that album that Gladstone Publishing put out paired Land Beneath the Ground with this story. So that's probably how it came to be a favorite of mine, I have to say, just because Land Beneath the Ground, I found so intriguing, and I came back to that story so many times that I just naturally would keep reading the next story, which, you know, is very strong, but I definitely am much more exposed to this story than I probably otherwise would have been. You know, can I also ask you, do you feel a little bit, what is it like being a female fan of these stories? You know, you mentioned that Little Lulu was kind of your outlet for getting to read little girl comics. These comics are not like directed at boys officially, but I mean, they are just overwhelmingly male, you know, and I do get to, I'm always happy to get to talk to Duck fans who are not men. And I've gone out of my way to bring women on the show, but I don't always get to bring longtime fans on the show who are. So I don't know. I don't want to make you feel self-conscious about it, but it definitely, I can see the demographic information for the podcast, and it's not the typical.
Yeah, I'm very aware that they're mostly men on the fan forums and that sort of thing. I think in my childhood, girls learned to be able to identify with male protagonists because you had to. In media generally, as I said, you know, it was nice to have Little Lulu. And in children's books, there were more female protagonists or now and then, right? That helped too. And in adulthood, I've definitely sought out Disney Duck comic stories that do highlight the female characters. And Indux has been a huge facilitator for my adult fanhood, because I'm able to find stories, particular stories I'm interested in, and then figure out what issues they're published in, and then order those issues from French or German eBay or something. I have read a lot of disproportionately many stories that highlight the female characters in positive ways. So that's been fun.
Right. Yeah, that's excellent. I know that there are some contemporary creators who have really tried to like elevate the female characters and just have more interesting portrayals of them. And so I think that's great. All right. So Elaine, why don't we go ahead and transition to talking about some of the background details of this specific comic, starting with the title. You know, I really like the title Pipeline to Danger, but I will say it does feel like maybe it should have been Big Operators. I don't know. I saw that there are some translations where they went with that title, and I'm like, Pipeline to Danger is a very gripping title, but thematically it kind of feels like it should have been Big Operators. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't naturally think of the title when I think of the story, and I think that's a sign that, yeah, you think of, you know, the Arab Ducknicks or or the Big Operators, absolutely, and that's connected with the theme.
Right. So let's see. Pipeline to Danger, though, as it's called, was published in April of 1960. So I'm acutely thinking about chronology of these stories when I do this, because I was just consuming them the way that whatever publishing company printed them, right? So right now I'm thinking, wow, we've just landed into the 60s. Technically, Barks developed this story at the very end of the 50s, though. And it came out in Uncle Scrooge number 30. It is a little bit shorter than the average adventure, clocking in at only 17 pages. And I like to check in on Index, that useful resource that tells me about how many times it's been reprinted. It kind of has a Big Operator number of reprints relative to what I would have expected. It is, it's been printed 10 times in the US in different forms, one form or another, in 20 countries overall, and in 113 appearances around the world, which is a bit more of an average number of reprints. But the US number of reprints kind of surprised me, because like I would say, maybe I'm not characterizing this one right, but I don't hear Duck fans talk about this one too often. The last thing to mention before we talk about this story itself is that one of the like typologies that Barks is famous for is these encounters that that he'll write with the ducks having of little people or little creatures. And this is something that's been discussed a lot, right? The plain awful Tonians are maybe not like minuscule, but they're definitely on the small side. We've got the measles. Later on, we'll have the micro ducks. We've got the little creatures from Island in the Sky. I'm sure there are a number of other ones. And I think, you know, people have pointed out why Barks does this. And you've got a quote that you can read for us, I think, about kind of Barks' own, in his own words.
Yeah, in talking about why he made many of these peoples that the ducks encounter smaller than the ducks, he said, "That makes a slight menace out of the ducks. They were always peewees in comparison with the villains. In order for them to become a menace, they had to come up against somebody smaller."
Yeah, it's a great comment. What do you think about that?
So, yeah, I think it's... especially since the ducks are started out being like half the size of the people-sized people, that when they go and meet another people, if they were all bigger than they are, like the people of Atlantis, that would make for a different dynamic. And it does mean that they can come in, and certainly in this case, posing danger to the little people that they meet.
Right.
As well as with the measles and the pewigas and the microducks.
Yeah, it always kind of immediately raises the stakes. I also wonder, too, if it's just something he felt he had to do to kind of keep an element of danger without making it too scary, right? Because, like, later on, you get the impression that he has to tone down the fear in some of these. And, the merfolk in Secret of Atlantis are quite a bit bigger, and they are initially pretty intimidating. And some of the characters even just a character the size of Neighbor Jones or Black Pete next to the ducks is kind of de facto intimidating. So it's interesting that he went back to this well so many times, right?
Yeah, and in this case, of course, it's also true that their being diminutive helps explain why they have not been discovered before, why they haven't been seen. So it's right. easier to have a hidden people when they're tiny, like the Pewigas or these Arab ducknecks.
Right. Let's see. Before we dive into kind of the narrative of the story, I like to take a moment, Elaine, to pander to international listeners, because that's another thing that demographic information about the podcast tells me, is that like we've got at least 40% of our listenership is like Scandinavian. It would not be surprising to duck fans, but if you're outside the audience, you might not expect that. Do you want to pick a title to mention from one of the other countries where this was published?
So the most recent French title is Le Peuple du Cratère en Péril, which is the people of the crater in peril, in danger.
Right. That seems like cool. I think so. And a lot of the titles do seem to be either direct translations of Pipeline to Danger, or some of them have gone with some variation of the big operators, which I really like. Mm-hmm. I speak some Spanish, so I'm always fascinated by learning new terms that I didn't previously know. So I'll name Spain's title. Their most recent one was Oleoducto al Peligro, which is a direct translation of Pipeline to Danger. So I like to learn the word for pipeline there.
So there are various ones that do some form of, you know, the people in the desert, the little desert people, something like
right.
that. I was amused that in one of the Danish that
yeah.
Earlier on in 1975, it was what is apparently the Lilliputians in the desert of the desert crater, right? It's the Lilliput Folket. I have no idea how to pronounce this. Iorkan Krateret.
Sounds convincing to
so
me.
So we use Lilliputian, you know, in English also as a generic for little people. And it was interesting to see that they do that in other languages too.
Right. And that term, of course, came from Gulliver's Travels. Let's see. So I think we've got some good background here and we are ready to launch into this. So Elaine, I always like to pay special attention to the opening panel. Number one, it's usually a splash panel and it's usually a bit of a showcase, a showpiece, right? But it also is supposed to do a lot of setup and kind of do some character and world building, just for, you know, potential new readers, because every story could be someone's first. So it's interesting to me that we get a little bit less signaling about Scrooge as a tycoon in this one. I mean, we certainly can tell that he's rich, but it really is less overt signaling about him being rich and more about him being a, quote, big operator, right? This big time man of business, of industry. And it focuses in on him being very directive and very authoritative. He is setting up this expedition to undertake this big project to develop a pipeline for his oil well in the Sahara Desert. And we've got the nephews looking on, commenting how our Uncle Scrooge commands whole fleets of ships and huge crews of men. And eventually, as they follow him around admiringly, they are going to highlight that he is a big tycoon, but more importantly, he is what is called a big operator. So the only other thing that I'll note is that we do get a couple of like place names in the Sahara. We're going to a region in the Erg El Doom, and Donald is going to come too. And they're kind of establishing that, you know, it's too much to pipe this oil to the seacoast. So they're going to look. This expedition is essentially to look for a backup solution, a way to store it. And in the second page, Scrooge is going to talk about how he wants Donald along to kind of learn the ropes. So Donald is going to be kind of the big operator in training, and the nephews are going to be very diminished in this early part. And they're going to call themselves little operators. Do you mind telling us about the panel where the nephews are just really deflated?
So Scrooge has told them to keep out of the way because they're only jobs for big operators. And then in the next panel, one of the nephews is pointing at the other two, mimicking Scrooge, saying, "No little operators." And they say, "Yes, sir, little operator, yes, sir," and look very dejected.
They really do. It's a very striking panel. I think it's one of the panels that I remembered like the most. I imagine it's probably something that you related to in reading this story.
In general, to that sense of always being too little, right?
It really strikes me. Like this panel, I think, is one that kind of runs through my brain a little bit. I'm always thinking about kids because that's like my day job. I work very closely with kids and the things that they internalize. And you get the impression that this brief little exchange with Scrooge, if they were real children, would be one of those things, that one of those offhand conversations that they would have held on to for the rest of their lives. And again, the rest of this sequence is really intended to set this operation. Everything about this is a big operation. And we don't see the usual Scrooge penny pinching here, right? Barks, we know, is very flexible with his characters. And he's determined that this has to be a big operation. So this has to be one of those spare no expense deals. We see this massive, once they arrive in the Sahara, there's this massive convoy of big trucks and sand cats in his desert caravan. It stretches for miles.
Yeah, even the decision to find a local place to store it rather than take it to the coast is not framed as saving money, surprisingly.
Yeah.
So you're right, there isn't any emphasis here on him saving money. And there aren't that many stories that focus on Scrooge as a businessman and actually doing the work of a businessman. And this one is very much so, from the opening panel on, focusing on that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that's a great point to make, because we have a few sort of Barks like typologies of stories. We've got like the treasure hunt that everyone imagines. There's a number of them where he is just seeking to kind of secure his fortune. But there's actually surprisingly few that are just about like business development, which is like a huge part of his character. I guess it's understandable. That's not the business of business is not as animating or as exciting, but it is a testament to Barks' storytelling that sometimes he is able to make that exciting. The only other one that's kind of coming to mind is the Mines of King Solomon, where it's more about like the overall operations rather than developing new business. But I think that's something I'm going to have to think on if there are many others like this that are just kind of plain business development.
If you think of the common categories of Scrooge adventures, you have the treasure hunt, as you say, you have the protecting his money, and you have the competition or race, right? And this isn't any of these. It's the closest analog to times when he tries to find another place to store all his cash,
right?
Because he's finding a place to store the oil. But it is different. It's a different feel.
Yeah, and you know, the crater itself does feel a bit money bin like in that regard. But yeah, this is a nice way to explore something a little bit different. So we're going to transition to this, you know, oil field region of the Sahara. This is not something, by the way, that I fact checked, but my understanding, my knowledge about like oil is that the Sahara is a very poor place for oil development. I think it has some oil, maybe around Libya, But of course, famously, most of that region's oil wealth is concentrated in like the Arabian Peninsula. But let's see, I guess this was at the tail end of the 50s when the big oil boom really was still occurring. And a lot of this region hadn't actually been developed. So it must have seemed natural that there could have been major oil fields there. But the Scrooge's oil field is classic, you know, full of derricks, surrounded, as Scrooge says, by shifting dunes. And we get a brief moment where he's pondering how he can't store the oil in sumps because the sand would absorb it like a sponge. And Scrooge is going to prefer to avoid costly metal tanks if possible. So we learn from one of his surveyors who's traveled by helicopter that they've located a lava crater 40 miles west that might make an ideal storage tank. So we're going to see the ducks go out by helicopter to explore this. Do you want to describe that little four-panel sequence?
Yeah, nice round, deep crater with lava at the bottom makes it leak-proof. And it's very telling that his first comment is that crater seems to have been built especially for me, right? Meanwhile, the nephews in the helicopter look down and see some odd shapes that they think look like tiny houses in a village. And Scrooge just brushes them off, says those they can't be anything but lava rocks. In a last panel that I really liked as a kid, I think that showing on the perspective of the floor of the crater that you get to see the little houses while Scrooge is dismissing that.
Right. I think you're absolutely right. That panel really hits. It's very still. It's kind of eerie. There really is something to the fact that Barks clues the readers in before he clues the ducks in. And I think it really fires your imagination to see these little huts. You don't know if they could have been abandoned a long time ago, although narratively you kind of know if it's being called out that, you know, maybe there are people there. It does give you a good idea, of course, that there are. But it looks really enchanting to me, this little, you almost feel your heart skip a beat and you want to gasp at what it means, you know, the possible consequences of filling this crater with oil. So the crater is like, the crater itself is huge. It's one of these geographical features that if it really existed, it would be almost like a protected heritage site, you know, because it's so cool and so imposing that the idea that Scrooge could just like dump a bunch of oil into it is a little bit silly, but it works just fine for comic book logic, right? And I will say that I don't know about whether, you know, the accuracy of if you can have a feature like this, but just Googling, I do see like in Western Sahara, there's an impact crater called Tenomir that was, I guess, once speculated to have been created by lava. So maybe this is the kind of like long time geographic feature that you can get. But yeah, it looks really cool though. And it looks really intriguing and that's good enough for me. So the next part of this story is going to be all about basically, it really is business development here. Right. It is Scrooge directing the operation and having Donald kind of be his apprentice here in learning how to handle a rig to drill a pipe hole down in here and secure it so that he can pump all the oil in. And I think what stands out to me about this one is that a different artist might have focused a little bit less on the details that make this feel like a very realistic operation to me, right? Because I see all these stacks of pipes surrounding it. I see this like cement plug, and there's like a booster pump at the end, you know, that is really meant to convey. I think 99 out of 100 artists would have just shown a direct pipe poking in to this crater. They wouldn't have bothered with something called a booster pump, which I did not look this up, but to me, it's clear that Barks has gone to some trouble to research how an oil pipeline should be depicted. And I think that's a great touch. The only other thing to mention here is, well, do you want to share with us what Scrooge kind of offhandedly references the legend that he's heard about?
Right. He says in the last panel there, "I've heard legends that the sun in this area shrinks people like drying prunes." So that's our foreshadowing. I do have one other thing to say about this page, and that is that the third and fourth panel repeat the third and fourth panel from the second page. That is, in the third panel, Scrooge is telling the kids to keep out of the way because we're only room for big operators. And the fourth panel is the kids' dejected response to feeling smaller every time and useless. And I just wanted to observe that the fact that they occur in the same place on the page as the earlier set pair of panels, I think re-emphasizes that sense of, I've seen this before, this is happening all the time, it's happening in the same way. It even happens at the same place on the page, you know, when my eyes light on it, I turn the page and it's there again.
Yeah, what a great catch. Thank you so much for pointing that out. As you say, if you just flip one page back, I mean, it's a couple of pages, but if you flip one page, it's in exactly the same position. And it's a very nice, like, it's well written too. Do you mind just reading the dialogue in those two panels for us?
Scrooge says, "And kids, you keep back out of the way. There's only room here for big operators." And then the kids talking to each other, "I feel smaller every time Uncle Scrooge yells at us, and more useless. I wonder if he'll ever have a job small enough for us to do."
Yeah, so it's just a great repetition of the theme, which really does need to be hammered home a bit in the 17-pager. And you really do feel, it's worth mentioning too, that this is so relatable. Even if you're not a youngest sibling, the chances are very good that you were a small child when you first read this story. What a great message to convey for little kids. I kind of glossed over the fact that early on, what the nephews were doing was focusing in on details, right? They were being detail oriented, which is a kind of a big operator thing to do. The mention of the sun shrinking people like drying prunes is a little bit of a heavy lift, right? It's the only thing that kind of, even as a kid, shook me out of this, because you're like, okay, well, there are other local people who haven't been shrunk like prunes, clearly. So it does feel a little bit paternalistic, but also it's, you know, this is necessary for the story beats to kind of play out the way that Barks wants them to. So, all right. So I'll tell you what, Elaine, would you like to characterize what happens on this next very intriguing page?
On the next page, as the ducks all sleep and the workers, you get the first sight and sound of the little people living in the crater, first at the end of the pipeline, making comments on what they see. "Strange are the wonders we see, and vast is the land beyond our mountain wall," which shows that they've never seen out beyond the crater. And then they go out, a couple of scouts go out and see Scrooge sleeping and say, "Creatures like us, only much bigger." And the helicopter, which they've seen flying, the great roaring bird, not a bird at all, but a thing of metal like our swords. And I think their way of interacting with what's unfamiliar to them is completely reasonable, right? They may first say a monster that roars, but when they look at it carefully, they say, "Oh, it's metal like our swords." You know, they don't continue to mythologize it or whatever. And then they see things they can take as souvenirs. So that leads to the vandalizing the work site.
I think your characterization of this is just spot on, right? The introduction of them really does stand out as they, I think it's very apparent that these are little people, not little creatures like the ducks will often encounter. Elaine, this page is doing so much, and it's so interesting, right? It really presents the I love the little transition to how it presents them, just the little people first with their eyes looking a little bit creepy. And then we see their silhouettes coming out on camelback, and they just look much more human at that point. And then we see them and they look just like the ducks, except little. And as you say, the way that they're talking strikes me as much more realistic than most comic book creators would do about regarding this kind of encounter. So I really like this encounter. I think it's fascinating. It occurs to me that these ducks are speaking in a bit of a poetic manner, right? It's not quite like the cadence of the Pee-wee Gaws from Land of the Pygmy Indians, but it's not too far off. And in tandem with what you pointed out about those two panels echoing each other, I think part of what really appeals to me about this story is that the whole thing feels, it has this very poetic undertone to it. I think the story itself reads like a poem with its repetition of big operator and little operator and the florid language in it. So on the next page, you know, the scouting party returns with some of their plunder, some cool, shiny things to take back to their sheik. And they're expressing their wonderment to him as well as their fear. And by the next morning, the big operation is back underway when they discover that their welding torches have disappeared alongside some other what seems to just be garden variety, you know, vandalism. And so, you know, Scrooge is going to call, he's going to call to his kind of main camp for spare parts. And this is going to give the ducks, the little crater ducks, the opportunity to listen into his conversation, which Scrooge says he's going to talk in a desert language since the supply crews are all natives. Arabic is pretty much the widely spoken language around here. I guess there are probably some other ones, but this is definitely a moment where Barks is kind of using, I think, some chicken scratch writing to represent this language. But again, it's just kind of a small little thing around the edges.
Right. That explains why Scrooge and the little ducks are going to be able to communicate too. So sometimes that gets hand waved, right, when you meet strange people, that they can understand each other. But right. Here it actually explains it. And it also does mean that the little ducks are not going to speak in pidgin English because they're speaking their own language. And the only thing distinctive about it, as you say, is that kind of poetic, often putting the adjective first, you know, great is the something, rather than the something is great.
Right. So we transition. I like the way this phone conversation has been handled, right? We get a little bit of narration after, where the little ducks are coming to learn what Scrooge intends to do, which is to pump their home full of oil. And they don't know what oil is, but they know this is bad news regardless, because there will be no room for them. And yeah, there's almost nothing worse that he could fill it with, right? So, you know, the ducks kind of reconvene. They can't find any sign of raider tracks or anything. So late in the day, they get some new supplies. They have the good idea. Scrooge has the good idea to smooth the sand so that they can look for tracks. And they're going to take watch with Donald taking the first turn and then Scrooge. And we get another of those big operator, little operator moments where the nephews are going to deflate. It definitely, Elaine, is different from what we normally see, where Scrooge is usually willing to involve the kids and trust the kids, but it really is just for the sake of the story. He needs to change that characterization a little bit. And I would say he's stretching it. He's not breaking. I really like that last panel in the story too. Night falls, where Donald is on guard with it's an oversized revolver and rifle and telescope. And I guess it's a normal sized one. But again, as we said, the ducks themselves are a little bit smaller than human size.
Yeah, I love that panel. And because of the contrast, as you earlier heard, the contrast of Scrooge saying, you know, there couldn't, the kids are imagining the village while you're seeing the village. Here you have the contrast of Donald saying, the raiders will have to be big operators to get by me. And you see that the raiders are getting by him precisely because they're little, right?
Right. Yeah, it's another moment where being kind of detail oriented is being a big operator. Do you want to characterize this next page where we've got the raiders kind of underway in the Ducks' camp?
Right. Here you have the scary, dangerous stretch where the one of the little ducks throws a torch into some gasoline to see if it will burn. And of course, it pushes into flames. And Scrooge wakes up from that. Everybody wakes up. And here the boys get to be in the last panel, you know, competent and on top of it. Don't panic, men. Grab the fire extinguishers and grab the shovels.
Yeah, you get the impression that they're eager for an opportunity to prove themselves. Did you notice the exclamation of the little duck, the crater duck, when the gas can burst into flames? He said, Allah Salimak, which I don't think it's quite exactly right. I think it's supposed to be essentially God save us. Is close to the expression. Maybe I'm overthinking it, but it would appear that these ducks are Muslim, right? That they subscribe to Islam if they're referencing Allah. So, you know, it begs a lot of questions that like are really a little bit too detail oriented and nerdy. Like there seems to have been some kind of exchange between the outside world and them. You know, their way of dress and their use of camels is very like area. It's typical of the area, right? Again, I'm overthinking it, but I couldn't help but notice that. By the next day, you know, they're kind of in recovery mode. It looks like they're going to be losing some more time. They're able to save their welding tools and most stuff so that they don't have to lose another day. They do spy some little tracks that they characterize like those of rabbits or dolls that lead nowhere. And you know, Scrooge is like, let's get on with this. You notice that he's still kind of wilting in the heat. And before they're able to connect that last section, he notes that there's a lot of sand kicked up into the pipe. So he directs them to bring up the compressor and blow it out. I love this little perspective shift where we see the little ducks in the pipe staring at the big compressor device saying, alack, we like not the looks of this. And we see it kind of pans back and forth and it blows them back into their crater along with their little diminutive camels. And I love the panel where they, do you mind reading the dialogue?
Great is the wind of the foreign giants. And great is the insult to these warriors of Kasba Crater. Even our camels vow vengeance on the one who calls himself the big operator. And the camel is hissing.
Yeah, I really like that sequence. It's just a nice little bit of color. And it kind of makes it a little bit more personal, too. They're like, they're just mad at Scrooge now. So Scrooge is now going to direct Donald to kind of boss this part of the operation. He's going to fly back to the head pump to do a final check. So this is a big opportunity for Donald, right? And it's, you can kind of see it in his eyes. This is also a different characterization. It's worth noting. Usually Donald is not kind of being set up as, there's kind of the implication that he's grooming Donald to be his successor here. When we know that in a lot of stories, he definitely doesn't go that direction, but this still makes sense. And Scrooge, we're meant to see that Scrooge is still wilting under this heat. It is, even if he's a big operator, it's hard for him to handle. So he's going to walk in solitude back to his helicopter. And he says, he's thinking to himself, such sunshine they have in this dune region. I shouldn't be surprised if it did shrink people. So, you know, we've got to have that reiterated one more time. And now he's going to have this very cool encounter with a camel mounted duck, mini duck, And another one just behind him who's going to throw a stone, knock him out. And these two ducks, these two mini ducks, are going to drag, as they say, this most mighty Pasha back into the crater to meet their sheikh. Do you know what a Pasha is?
No.
So I did Google this. I didn't know it without doing due diligence. But it's just an esteemed person, apparently. So very fitting. Barks has obviously, he's obviously going to the, he's going to the lengths to use, I would say, terminology that is much more respectful to his probably young readership than the average creator would do.
I do love the encounter panel. And in the Gladstone album, that's used not as the cover. Oddly, this is in an album with Yoix the Fox, and very oddly, it was Yoix the Fox that got on the cover. What? But as a lovely title page just inside the cover, where it was colored by Susan Daigle Leach, who does a better or Sue Daigle at the time, maybe. Susan Daigle Leach, who does a better job of the coloring than was done in the story itself, which was colored by somebody else.
Great points there, especially on calling out the excellent coloring of Susan Daigle Leach, who, I thought about it at one point and I'm like, I bet I've read more Susan Daigle Leach stories than any other person involved in creating comic books. But I think for the most part, her coloring is just a delight. And mentioning that Yoix the Fox, which is like the 10-pager that follows this story originally, I think, in Uncle Scrooge number 30, that's part of why I was like, this story is kind of weirdly anonymous, right? It's a weird choice not to give it the cover spot for that, like, you know, elaborate album reprint. Very strange. So let's see. This is the segment now where Scrooge is going to be held captive by these people within the crater. Before he gets to like wake up and actually encounter, we do have another repeat of that compressor moment. It's pretty funny. It's entertaining. There's not really too much to say about it, except that it's what helps the little ducks along, get Scrooge inside and wakes up Scrooge. And we have a little transition where they counsel him to speak their language as he's wondering where he is. We're going to see them take Scrooge to meet their sheikh, Hazan ben Happy. You know, this is a funny little gag that I feel like this. What do you think, Elaine? This is something that Barks does a lot. And a lot of comic creators of the era have done. And you hear this in pop culture a lot, these little goofy foreignish names that equate to some kind of a pun in the language, you know, in English. And they always cracked me up as a kid. And now that I'm just like a 43-year-old man who thinks these things too much, who some people would criticize as being overly woke or whatever. They don't quite hit the same way that they used to. I don't know if you have similar thoughts or the opposite kind of thoughts.
It's true that I'm a little more leery of them now. But on the other hand, the characters who are coded white back home get funny names too. So if it were only the characters that were coded something other than white that got funny names, I would be more disturbed.
Right.
And, you know, in a way, taking something that is a common name in that culture and using that for the pun, it's an obvious thing to do. I don't know that it's that disrespectful unless the characterization generally is disrespectful.
Yeah, it's definitely a fair point to note that it's something he's going to do for characters that are coded white as well. I suspect if you went through, it's usually either done at characters that Barks wants to poke a little bit fun at or villainous characters. But, you know, as you said, this story is largely very respectful and it's a very minor thing. It's just one of those things that I have a podcast and it's something that I can dwell on and process a little bit. So let's see. We have a very cool panel where Scrooge gets to meet the Sheik, who is sitting there smoking a hookah, which, you know, is pretty innocuous culturally. And it looks actually like pretty accurately represented, but it also is certainly something that you can't see in a Disney comic these days. I think smoking is pretty taboo. This is the only time I can think of a character using hookah, though. And we see Donald very efficiently and very successfully bossing this job to its almost conclusion. He comments he's proud Uncle Scrooge himself couldn't have done it faster. The man references him as Foreman Donald, and the nephews say this day's work will make Uncle Donald a big operator too. So it's kind of perfect here, right, Elaine? Donald is being extremely competent and capable at what prophetically turns out to be the worst moment for him. So now we have this dire moment. Do you want to tell us about this very grave exchange between Scrooge and the Sheik?
So the Sheik is asking, what is this stuff you're going to pump in? Scrooge is saying, nothing if I can get back to my crew and stop them. I didn't know anybody lived in here. Honest, I didn't. And the Sheik says, you looked not well, which is deep truth, right? He was even warned by the kids and he still didn't look well. And it is his fault. Then he says, you know, let me out. I'll start to stop the pumps. And the Sheik asks, how do we know you're going to come back? And my favorite panel, Scrooge stands up proudly and says, you have my word. I am famed in every capital of the world as Honorable Scrooge McDuck. And the Sheik says, never heard of you in this capital. I just love that. It's the kind of essence of the theme of this story, not the big little so much, but what is honor and what is reputation, right? And this is on a different scale. And on this scale, where he's established his reputation just doesn't count.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about this panel. And I'm so glad that you read it out, because this is one of those that really does demand to be read aloud. And this four panel sequence really stands out to me. I think it's really excellent. You've got, you know, this contrast between the Sheik kind of sitting there languidly and Scrooge desperately kind of BSing a little bit. I'm kind of reminded of Tra-la-la, where he was reluctant to actually admit to the Tra-la-la-ians until the nephews, you know, told him to be honest what is actually coming. It's very reminiscent, right? The fact that those bottle caps were going to fill the valley in the same way that the oil is about to fill the valley. So, you know, without the nephews next to him, he's kind of regressing into that not willing to tell the truth, although he does kind of get to it because he has no choice here. And then I love how the panel, when they're having that conversation, Barks is so smart. It is such good storytelling to flash out of the panel from the inside of the Sheik's building and to see the village, which of course is telling us about the stakes of what's going to happen. It's a really brilliant decision that he made there. So the next page and really the next sequence is going to be devoted entirely to Scrooge's attempt to escape, to save his own skin, but also to save these other ducks. You know, he distracts them by tossing out some trinkets, and he attempts to make it to the pipe before it's been sealed so that he can yell at Donald to stop the work, lest he be trapped there. But we get the moment that we knew was coming, that the whole thing's kind of been leading up to the big oil moment, and a big gusher of sludge splashes right onto Scrooge. And the little ducks are horrified to see that's the stuff that you would pump into our crater, big operator. I haven't really highlighted it, but one of the ways that I've changed a little bit since I read this as a kid is I found the idea of pumping this oil into a crater. Of course, it's, you know, it's gross, as you would see right here, and it's dangerous to these ducks, but the intervening couple of decades have definitely changed kind of my appreciation, shall we say, of the oil industry itself and pipelines themselves and the big problems. So we're meant to find Scrooge very, you know, relatively sympathetic in this story. I would say kind of the big business aspect of this is presented as a good thing. And I'm not so naive as to not realize that, you know, this is also like job creation and industry, et cetera, et cetera. But there's obviously a lot of big problems associated with the industry that Scrooge is involved in. And I don't have too much to say about that, Elaine. It's just one of those ways one of those things I can't help but think about now.
Yeah, I think that this story is a good instance to argue against the kind of people who say that the Scrooge story is imperialistic, or, you know, that they valorize big business and taking your big business to places all over the world, because this does focus on Scrooge as a businessman, but it does not valorize that, right? That as we have become more familiar with lately, you know, the awareness of pipelines endangering indigenous peoples, that's exactly what happens here. The pipeline endangers indigenous peoples, and he should have known because he didn't look well. And it is his fault. So that is all part of the story, right?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to think about. I would say that the presentation of business here is kind of almost neutral, right? It's almost a natural order of the world, which makes some sense, right? Because Scrooge is the consummate capitalist, and Barks, of course, was a capitalist. But it is fair to point out that he at least is pointing out the kind of danger that this can present, the kind of unintended consequences. And it's also just a jaunty little adventure with putting some little ducks in peril. So, you know, Scrooge is, oh, I really like that panel where Scrooge is just horrified about the pump starting. He knows how dangerous, how bad this is. But the little ducks haven't internalized yet. And partially that's because he presents himself as this big operator. And they're like, what, you can't stop these pumps? He's pointing out he can't yell loud enough to be heard over the crater wall. Do you want to read the little duck's rejoinder to him after he says that?
Surprised are we. Without your mighty things that roar and snort and ring bells, you be little bigger than us.
Yeah. Again, it's very poetic. It's what did I learn? In Land of the Pygmy Indians, Barks was using the cadence from Song of Hiawatha called iambic tetrameter. I think I'm remembering that right. But it looks like he's only doing it on like the first line here, right? The surprised are we. And then they kind of just slip into some fairly poetic English. I love this moment here where Scrooge starts to try to scramble up the crater wall only to immediately fall with a thud. And a little duck, and this is a line that really stood with me, right? In 3,000, he says, very solemnly, in 3,000 lifetimes, nobody has ever climbed out of Kasbah crater. So there's a lot in that panel, right? We get a little name for the crater, right? Which a Kasbah is like a rocky fort, I believe, a fortification. And we get a reference to how long these ducks have been there. Although I imagine that's got to be a little bit of exaggeration. I don't know.
Unless their lifetime is also smaller in proportion with their size.
right. Yeah, which is a very sad little thought. I think it also kind of, it's interesting that they seem resigned very quickly. And they're very stoic, right? Because Scrooge is going to keep trying. He's going to try to signal the crew with a smoke message, with some matches that are still intact, but there's apparently an air inversion above that doesn't allow the smoke to rise to where they can see it. So I like that Barks has Scrooge make a couple of real efforts to do something. I feel like he does enough groundwork to show us, you know, that he's really at a loss. He's really helpless here. What do you think?
Yeah, he certainly keeps trying. And the fact that the little ducks are resigned and stoic, as you say, is, you know, from their countless generations of experience that there's no way out and no way even to get to the top to look out.
Yeah, it's pretty affecting, I think. And just as affecting is the little bit on the next page where they point out, you know, maybe someone as great as you will be missed by your followers. So they'll come with the big roaring birds to find you. But Scrooge points out, I'm not going to be missed till nightfall. And at that time, the oil will be this deep over our heads. I love how he uses his cane to indicate that level. And at that point, we see some off-panel exclamation points signaling their dismay. But they do remain stoic, he says. One of them says, "We can face it, big operator. Perhaps you are big enough to do as much." I just find that very very, very sobering, very notable. Barks doesn't have these little characters in this story for all that much time, but they left a big impact to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that line especially hit me very deeply as a child reader. I was very impressed with their valor. Right? I mean, valor in the truest sense of courage in the face of certain death.
Right.
And that's part of how respectfully these people are treated by Barks.
Yeah, I agree. Because basically at this point, everyone in that crater understands that they're almost certain to die, which is, it's a very chilling thing in this little kid's comic here. This is some very real danger. And it's a really horrible death that they're all going to face there if you actually dwell on this, right? So Elaine, do you want to, this next sequence, the ending sequence here, the last couple of pages, really is, it's kind of one sequence. Do you want to take it home, these last 2.5 pages?
So the second half of this page, the boys are beginning to find clues of what has happened. They realize that Scrooge's helicopter is still here. They see more of the rabbit tracks and marks of something being dragged, and alert Donald that apparently Scrooge hasn't left, ask him to stop the pumps. But Donald reasonably says that, you know, the pumps are a big operation and he doesn't feel he can stop pumps for such slim evidence as that. Now, in a way, that's dismissing what the boys have seen in the same way that Scrooge dismissed what they saw in this crater in the first place. But the boys know there's something wrong, and the only way we can prove it is by doing something big, one of them says. So they climb the outside of the crater, which is big work for little operators, but they get all the way to the top, and they have binoculars and look down, and they see Uncle Scrooge and call Uncle Donald and call off the oil. And the Huey, Dewey, and Louie get decorated with shiny medals, which say big operator. And I don't know how often Barks breaks the fourth wall, but one of the nephews actually looks at the reader and winks.
Yeah.
And says, "Big operator," they say.
It's very cute.
Uh-huh. And then a new deal comes to Casba Crater, the narration box says, and the little ducks are rejoicing in the rich soil that Honorable McDuck flew in and the water that he piped in. And Scrooge comments, and then he's spent millions of dollars to make the crater bloom. But after what happened, I had to. It was the only way I could ever prove to them that I really am a big operator.
Well, there's so much. I love the ending. I think Barks is a genius. His endings aren't always the strongest, but I love this ending. Mm-hmm. And there's just a lot to think about. I love that little shot of the nephews proudly wearing their big operator badges. I love that Scrooge is so concerned about his reputation with these totally isolated little ducks. It's strikingly generous, but even though it's definitely out of character for Scrooge, we've seen moments like this where there is a time and a place for his generosity, and he is getting reputation out of it. But you also sense that there is maybe a profound guilt about the terrible thing that he almost did.
They have a legitimate wall. So I like the fact that it the boys getting their medals is not the climax of the story by itself, which it could have been, right? That you need to have a resolution for the people in the crater and give them something to make up for what they've been put through. And the return, a double return then to that theme at the end, boy, that the both that the boys get to be acknowledged as big operators because of saving the day by trusting their own observation of detail and making that very hard climb up the crater wall. They get to be recognized as big operators. But Scrooge also has to reestablish himself as legitimately a big operator, really by being ethical, by being an ethical businessman and making up somehow to the people whose lives and, you know, existence and culture he threatened.
Yeah, it's a fascinating, fascinating thing to think about. As you say, this story might be a little bit of a rejoinder to the criticism that I think was, what was that book called, How to Read Donald Duck? I've never actually read that one. I understand that a lot of it has kind of been countered. Even its writers have kind of conceded that some of their premise was faulty. But I definitely think there's there is certainly some room to offer up that kind of criticism or thought. And I say criticism in the true sense of the word.
Uneasiness that all of us have with loving a protagonist who is a, you know, uncounted gazillionaire, right?
Exactly.
Why isn't he doing something better with all that money than just hoarding it?
Right.
And as that was kind of Barks's rejoinder when people accused him of being an ultra-capitalist in this, is that Scrooge is not a capitalist. He would destroy the capitalist system because he just brings in all the money and hoards it.
Right. Yes, he's like a dragon.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of, you know, Barks as an ultra-capitalist, it's interesting, the little narrator box very clearly says a new deal comes to Casbah Crater. And this is certainly not something I would have picked up on as when I read this when I was, I think I was 7 when I read this. That wording is unavoidably referencing Roosevelt's New Deal at the end of the Depression, which, you know, Barks, I'm sure, had his own ideological criticisms of, but probably also grew up in an era where it was also widely accepted as being necessary and would have had firsthand experience with. So I don't know that I have any other insight other than to say, wow, isn't it interesting?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that is it, Elaine. That is Pipeline to Danger. And I have to say, I came into this one thinking, boy, I have some really fond recollections of this story. It probably doesn't hold up as well as my childhood memory of it, and the fact that I just read and reread it so much because it was tagged along with Land Beneath the Ground would suggest. But I have to say, going through this right now and really devoting some significant thought into this and getting to appreciate some of the great storytelling, the great sequencing that he's done in this, I think you're right. I don't know that I would put this in my top 10 or anything, but I would say, we'll come to this when we look at the community reaction to it, but I would say that this is a sorely underrated story, that this is a bit of an early 60s gem that is a delight to read and has a lot to offer.
Yeah, I'm bemused by the fact that it isn't more recognized and valued. And I collect, you know, the cheapest possible Duck Comics collection, which is of trading cards from all over the world. And neither the Gladstone nor the recent big Pixu series of many, many trading cards set in the Duck world had a trading card for this story. You know, they have the Neasles, they have the Pewigas. Gladstone had the Islanders in the Sky. They both have the Microducks and other races, you know, obviously Plain Awful and Terry's and Fermi's. And these little Arab ducknicks don't get their own card. I had to make my own card.
That's adorable.
And I'm not sure why. I don't know whether it's the lack of really impressive art, the fact that the setting is a little more bare, a comparison in unconscious comparison with Tralala because of filling up the valley and this one isn't as good as Tralala or something. I don't know.
Right.
But I really do think it's undervalued.
Yeah, I don't know what it is about it, but I think if anything from this episode, you and I can maybe help it along with some of a bit of a critical reassessment. That's one of my favorite things to do in this series is to really try and recognize and uplift some of the stories that I think are sorely underrated. And I've got to say, this one definitely qualifies. You know, I'm looking, it's not even included on Rose's little poster depicting, you know, some of the quote races.
Yes, right. I was surprised that he did do one other illustration that combined several of the sort of desert-based stories.
Yes, that's
that
true.
That had them in it. But yeah, that they don't even, and they wouldn't take up very much space.
No, certainly not.
But they didn't make it into that.
And they look so enchanting atop their haughty little camels. It's great. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think this story lands very well. And I know you do, it being a top 10 of yours. And I understand why. I always like to check in on what the wider community thinks. And Index is a great representative of that. So if we check in as of right now, this one has a 7.5 rating. Which is good for number 296 on Index, you know, which, of course, Index lists thousands and thousands of stories. So in the scheme of things, of course, that's quite high. But I've plucked out all of the Bark's adventure stories so that I could kind of see where they fall relative to each other. And this one is 77th on his list of roughly 122, quote, adventure length stories, which puts it in the 63rd percentile. And I think we're probably in agreement that that is just dramatically undervaluing this excellent story. I will note that oftentimes when we've got one of these shorter stories, I'll have the comment that, you know, maybe it would have been better if it had gotten a couple of more pages to breathe. I don't think that's the case with this one.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it's very well constructed and you have just as much as you need all the way through, just as much as you need of the life in the crater, just as much as you need of the repetition of the big operator, little operator stuff before. So,
right. That's exactly my thought. It also doesn't really have a weak segment at all. You know, like the intro, the ending is very strong. Thematically, mm-hmm. Barks is just really effectively hitting home that idea that size is like literal size is not what's important. I want to make sure that I don't utter size doesn't matter to make that point. You know, it's size is not what's important, but it really is how we act, how we guide ourselves, how whether we're able to act morally and ethically that preserves, you know, our reputation. I like the happy ending for the little ducks. This one just lands so nicely.
That another place where Barks has a similar theme is with Gyro's Helper. And Gyro's Helper, of course, being tiny, but often, very often saving the day. And there are a couple of stories, especially Snowduster, where similar to this story, what happens between Scrooge and the boys in Pipeline to Danger happens between Gyro and Helper. That is that Gyro initially dismisses Helper or what he's doing. So in A Helper's Helping Hand, Gyro is painting faces on toys and dolls, which Gyro dismisses as he wants a real He-Man job, right? And then, of course, that's what saves the day at the end, that Helper can do this. And in Snowduster, he says to Helper on the first page, "You can't tag along, though, Helper. You're too small to be of any help on such a big job." So it very much echoes the same kind of dynamic about what kind of bigness really matters, a bigness of heart, right? And a bigness of imagination and attention to detail. You do sometimes wonder in that, like painting faces on dolls, whether there's any piece of Barks sympathizing with that, because, you know, his lifelong work is making comic books for kids. Right.
Yeah, that is another excellent point to have made. I'm glad as soon as you said that, I was like, oh, yeah, of course. And I wish I had thought of that. So, yeah, that's true. Helper is definitely kind of analogous to these. It's such a great little story beat to convey to little kids, right? It's what a great thing to present to them. I always like to take a moment to note any follow-ups or adaptations. This is really not one that had any kind of extended life. It was never adapted, to my knowledge, into like a DuckTales, or it didn't have any big sequels or anything like that. So I think we've covered this, Elaine, very effectively. The only thing that I did want to touch on is I always like to ask people if there are any panels that they'd really like to highlight as a special favorite. I know we've definitely mentioned a number of them. So do you feel like there are any that we didn't give proper appreciation, or that you'd like to really come back to and make special note of?
I think I've mentioned my four favorites as we went through it. When you first see the little houses, the last panel on three, the last panel on seven, when you know, you have the irony of Donald saying you have to be a big operator to get by me. And meanwhile, you see the little ducks getting by him precisely because they're little, in Scrooge's first encounter with the little duck. And then my favorite panel of all, the one where he boasts, you know, "You have my word. I'm known in every capital of the world as the Honorable Scrooge McDuck." And that deadpan answer of the Sheik, "Never heard of you in this capital." And I just love the way that encapsulates the conflict and the central ideas of the story about what really is honor. What's he going to have to do in the end to understand himself as honorable?
Now, I agree. I think I would echo pretty much all of your choices there. I do love that sequence. Is a real knockout to me. Likewise, Donald standing guard. I like the silhouette of the little ducks emerging for the first time from their pipeline. And I really liked just kind of imagining their insular little society and what a big deal this whole encounter must have been for them. You know, this is such a life-changing, a society-changing thing. And for once, the ducks actually leave one of these societies better off than when they discover it. Those panels that you mentioned that are the big echoes of each other, with the nephews feeling so deflated, are real standouts. This story is really visually great. It's so poetic. It really resonates with me, and I'm really glad that we got to go to bat for this one. All right. So, Elaine, thank you so much for joining me for this conversation. It was a real delight, and I'll look forward to having you on in the future for one that I know you're equally passionate about.
Yeah. Thank you for having me, Mark. It's really fun to talk about Barks stories with somebody else who values them so highly. As you say, as American fans, we don't have enough experience of this. So it's really great when it can happen.
Exactly. This is me forcing people on with me for a couple of hours to talk ducks. And listeners should check us out. Barks Remarks can be found on Facebook and Instagram to a certain extent these days. And check in. The next episode is going to cover All at Sea. Once again, Elaine, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark. Look forward to the next time.